much, Eva, for a very many-sided paper, which actually connects in many ways with our project on French in Russia. Some of the things you've been talking about, such as the differences between public and private use, and the use between women and men, and languages between women and men, very much the sort of things that we're addressing. I've got a few questions myself, but I'd like to open it up to other people first. So, any questions from you?
Obviously, Voltaire, very influential at that time, also as well. But you didn't mention Diderot. How important was the encyclopedia in spreading French thought and French in that area of practical applications to knowledge?
I think Diderot was exceptional, mainly in his personal influence. I would say that the French encyclopedia was widespread. It is present in all aristocratic libraries in Bohemia, in catalogues. So he was known as a writer. Some aristocrats like Philipp Joseph Liechtenstein were copying his works. So you may find their manuscripts with copies of his of some entries from the encyclopedia, for example, or his articles for the Salon. But he was exceptionally mainly in his willingness to establish personal contacts with aristocrats. And at that time, it became fashionable to travel to France during the Grand Tour, the Cavalier's Tour, and meet these French philosophers in person. And Diderot was the person, the philosopher who was most willing to meet Bohemian aristocrats. So I know from some travel diaries, travel accounts, that welcomed Bohemian aristocrats in Paris, for example, in 1770 during the wedding festivities on the occasion of the wedding of the future Louis the 16th and Marie Antoinette. Also Diderot was willing to meet Bohemian aristocrats and even serve as a kind of guide for them through Paris. He was guiding them, helping them to establish contacts with some other philosophers. The least accessible was Rousseau, who was a kind of introverted person, as it seems, but Diderot managed to organize or to mediate an audience even with Rousseau.
Thank you. I'm working on the standardization of German in the 18th century Austria. And I wondered, I'm also looking at school books, and I wondered if you know what language the school books were written in Bohemia in the 18th
century. Well, it depends on which school books you're interested in. Well, aristocrats did not go to public schools, to elementary schools, even after the Theresian reform. They had private preceptors. These preceptors would often write manuscript textbooks for them, which differed according to the discipline which was discussed. So French was used, taught in French, then Latin in Latin. French was sometimes used even for teaching mathematics, physics, history. Well, I would say that usually these practical subjects like mathematics, geography, and so on was taught in German. But it's different in each family, and moreover, the situation or not all of these textbooks survived till today, so it's difficult. Our picture is certainly distorted by the fact that only a fraction of these manuscript textbooks survived till today. And textbooks used in public schools were written in German and Czech, because it was Habsburg monarchy allowed teaching in Czech at the elementary level. You know, at the university, the lessons were given in German or Latin, but at the elementary schools, Czech was used in Czech-speaking regions. Hmm. There is one textbook which you might be interested in, written by František Martin Pelcel, which is trilingual. It is in Czech, German, and French. And it is an account of grammar. It includes also some modal conversations and some short stories, some brief anecdotes, some short anecdotes, which are written in these three languages. And it was printed. It was printed. It's available. Yeah. And what might be also interesting for you are textbooks or scholarly works written by students of the Theresian Academy in Vienna, where Johann Michael Denis was teaching Schöne Wissenschaften, and he published a series of literary almanacs with works of his students, and one of them includes a study or an essay on the topic which you are interested in, on the standardization of German in Austria. I don't, if you know, Wolfgang Martens has written an article about it, if you know that.
I haven't come across that.
It has been published. It has been published in the two-volume history of Austrian literature, edited by Herbert Semann. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this article by Wolfgang Martens is quite important. And you may find you may consult the original work as well. It is called Jugendfrichte. Jugendfrichte aus dem Theresianum.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I just wonder, I know it's not quite your field, but would you be able to give some general comments on the abilities of these, the mastery of French, and their competence in relation to other languages?
I'm not, my own French is not so good to be able to evaluate the to assess their skills, but there are some contemporary comments, we may also assess them on the basis of biographical data. So Lamberg was a native speaker of French because his family was living for a longer time in Austria, Netherlands, in Belgium. He was educated in French. So actually you see that he has never written anything in German. Everything, the German versions of his works are translations done by other people. So I think his French was good, einwandfrei, I would say. Charles-Joseph de Ligny, I think there is a lot of literature on his French written by Belgian scholars, and so his French is usually assessed as good, containing some elements of dialect. But for example, that epistolary novel has been assessed by the Belgian editors as being very poor in terms of language, as being very, very, very simple. Charles-Joseph Clary Aldringen, his grandson, was actually also a native speaker, because his mother was the daughter of Charles-Joseph de Ligny. He was also educated in French. He was bilingual, unlike Lamberg. He also wrote some things in German, and he was, for example, he was translating some works, some of Goethe's works into French. You know, so he was trying to work with both languages, with German and French. He was also translating works by Walter Scott, for example. So I think his French was also good, and he was himself actually mocking bad French, for example, of Prussian officers. Or I think that that was good. Hartig was non-native speaker. He is usually, that is quite paradoxically often quoted as a typical example of a Francophone aristocrat who did not learn German, because he was president of the Academy of Sciences, the Böhmische Gelehrtengesellschaft, and upon entering the society, the academy, he was asked, as all members, to submit his autobiography, and in this autobiography he claimed that he could not speak could not speak German in his childhood, that he originally learned only French. But I know from comments from other aristocrats that his French was bad, that it was not a language in which he would express himself naturally. I think this is also the reason why he later switched to German. And as for Alexander Shvalov, I don't know. I don't know. But maybe I think maybe the question you posed also referred to the possibility of their French being archaic anyway, as it was the case with Catherine the Great, because Catherine the Great had the reputation of speaking archaic, old-fashioned French, because she was taught by French Huguenot refugees who preserved the French as it existed at the end of the 17th century. I think this was not the case in the Catholic Habsburg monarchy, because Catherine the Great, or Russia, which was an Orthodox country, might have some problems with Catholic French from France or from Belgium, and perhaps they would prefer Huguenot refugees. But we were a Catholic country, and actually Catholicism was usually the main condition, the main criterion for a Francophone preceptor. So our aristocrats did not want any Protestants. So they were all people who came from France, who were speaking the contemporary language. So there was no reason for any archaisms. And we also have some very flattering remarks by French emigres, like Baroness de Monte, who has written Mes Souvenirs, in which she describes the world of aristocratic salons in Vienna, and in which she praises French spoken by Austrian aristocrats as being completely natural. So that's it. Thanks very much.
And presumably these people didn't speak Czech very well at all, or didn't speak it at all?
As I said, at the end of the 18th century, there appeared the fashion of teaching sons, as presumed heirs, teaching sons Czech. But I'm not sure whether they were able to speak the language naturally. For example, that textbook written by František Martin Pelcel contains also some funny dialogues in Czech. Things like, could you take off my shoes, please? Things like that. So you see that they actually needed Czech for a kind of conversation with their servants.
Yes.
And there is also a wonderful manuscript textbook of Czech, which was written for Prince von Schwarzenberg, in which there are also really funny dialogues, like dialogue between Prince Schwarzenberg and his subject, who asks him about the way from Vienna to his domains, and which villages have you traveled through, Your Highness, and things like that. And, this textbook is very interesting as for the vocabulary, but I'm not sure whether they were able to use the language in practice. The second occasion in which they used Czech was the Bohemian Diet, because Czech had a very schizophrenic status of being on one side the language of servants, and on the other side the sacred Landessprache, the sacred language of the country. For this reason, it was used during the opening ceremony of the Diet. There were some fixed phrases which had to be said, questions and answers. Something like when the British Parliament is open. But here in Bohemia, it was compulsory that these phrases had to be set in Czech.
I wanted to ask about any possible influence in things that you've been looking at in the 19th century of romantic ideas about language and national identity which come from Germany, and whether there's a consciousness of this among the people you've been researching into, and whether any of their views about which language they should use, whether it should be German or French or indeed Czech, are affected by these linguistic ideas in the Romantic period.
Well, I haven't found any direct influence of Herder or other people discussing these things on the aristocrats. But one of them, Franz Josef Kinski, argued in favor of Czech in his work on the education of nobility, in which he claims that the nobility should speak the language of the country in which they live, and those living in Bohemia should learn and speak Czech, because this is the language of the country. And as I said, there was this fashion, but I think it was this fashion of studying Czech, which starts at the end of the 18th century, was not motivated by the linguistic ideas coming from, for example, Germany. It was mainly, the main reason was the relationship to the country and family traditions. It can be proved on the example of the Schwarzenberg family, which includes the lessons of Czech in the education of the firstborn son immediately after acquiring the first domain in Bohemia in the 1660s. And then you may see that they were actually they were giving lessons of Czech to their sons in every generation until the Czech national revival. And we have similar proofs from Thun family, I think. Now I can't remember exactly. Where there is one letter preserved from the middle of the 17th century in which the count says, if we acquire a domain in Bohemia, we will have to start teaching our sons Czech, because this is the language of the country. So I think that there were these domestic reasons for studying Czech. But otherwise, these ideas were known to Bohemian scholars like Dobrovský, who was very sensitive to these ideas coming from Germany. And as I said, we may also see some similarities between the arguments put forward in defense of Czech language and some esoteric ideas which appeared at the time in Germany, like the idea of a chosen nation in the last period of human history, apocalyptic visions, prophecies, and so on.
Are there any further questions?
It's just a small question following your question. Yeah. You seem to be emphasizing teaching sons, teaching Czech to sons, and yeah. How about the daughters?
Well, I think that they were teaching just sons, because it was supposed that they will need Czech as the future possessors and of the domains and future Landesväter, as future economists. Women were not prepared for this role, so at this time there are no traces of aristocratic women studying Czech.
So it means they're supposed to speak French?
French and German. French and German.
Well, presumably for perhaps for charitable works or dealing with servants, I did, but even some Czech.
Who?
If they were carrying out works, good works, works of charity, among local peasants, or perhaps dealing with servants, they might be Czech for that.
For charity?
Yes.
I think, well, Well, I think they could have picked up some words, but I think that would be enough. You know, you sometimes find in aristocratic letters some inserted words in Czech, like všechno, co je dobré, to je dobré, things like that. So I think that on a, like at a charitable event, giving soup to to some poor peasants or something like that, I may imagine that an aristocratic lady would be able to utter some some words of this kind. But well, that would be necessary only in the Czech-speaking regions. There were lots of the regions in which they were living, in which they had their chateaus and palaces, were inhabited by German-speaking population.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you found much of about professional translators, be they Czech or, well, Czech-speaking or German, French?
Professional translators? Yeah. I mean, generally? Or?
Well, I was just thinking if these noble ladies were going around and didn't have much Czech, if they maybe had someone with them to help.
Oh. Yeah, they had Czech servants, so they could certainly find somebody who could interpret for them.
Would it be ad hoc? It'd be informal rather than...
Yeah, in an informal way. Professional translators, you know, some of the members, representatives of the Czech National Revival, obrozenci, as we call them, they were translating German, English or French works deliberately on their own from their own, will. Perhaps I don't know whether we could call them professional translators, because I suppose that they did not get any profit from it. They didn't could not make a living on translating these works. But well, they were doing that deliberately on their own. There were professional translators employed by the Landesgubernium, which was the highest administrative office in the country. They had an institutionalized office called Translator, and these people had the assignment to translate new laws or governmental instructions into Czech. It's a very fascinating topic. I have one student who is now writing her master thesis on these translators, translatores, because I have found some manuscript works done by these translators in the 1780s, and some works connected with the competition for the job, you know, and some handwritten apologies for Czech. So it's an interesting topic.
Well, I think we should probably be finishing now, as it's getting late. But I'd like to thank you again for a very interesting talk, very useful contribution to our series, actually. And it occurs to me that, especially listening to your answers as well as to your talk, that the situation's in many ways quite different from the situation we're looking at in Russia, and more complex, because whereas in Russia the fundamental debate is about whether nobles should be speaking French or Russian, here it's not such a simple thing,
yeah,
whether they should be speaking French or Czech. It's German or French rather than Czech. So it's an interesting and complex situation. I'd like to thank you very much once more. Two things before we go. Just to tell people here that our next seminar is in a fortnight's time on the 1st of November, and that will be by Professor Wim van den Buske from one of the universities in Brussels, and he'll be talking about the language situation in Belgium. And although, of course, in line with what we're doing on this project, his talk will be of a historical nature, clearly that's a subject which has great topicality, I think, in view of the contemporary language disputes in Belgium. And secondly, we will go and have a drink in Hawthorns, and anyone is welcome to join us for that, just across the road in a moment. So thank you very much again.